So at this time, the court would like to call cause number 19-456-CV Carrie Scruggs versus Rockport Terminal. And who represents the appellant?
Michael Meyer, representing the appellant, Your Honor. And we wish to reserve 5 of our 20 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Lorian White for Rockport Terminals, LLC, the appellee. And I'd like to reserve all of my time, but I'll try to give time back to the court if it's not necessary.
Thank you, Ms. White. All right. At this time, everybody can see the clock. We can all hear each other. And as soon as the clock starts ticking, Mr. Meyer, you can proceed with the appellant's argument.
Your Honor, my name is Michael Meyer. I represent Councilwoman Carrie Scruggs. She's an elected city council person from the city of Grand Pass. This is the interlocutory appeal of a decision of the trial court denying a motion that Ms. Scruggs made to dismiss the case pursuant to the Anti-SLAPP Act. Reviews de novo. The case arises out of two separate postings Ms. Scruggs made on Facebook. The first posting, made on May 4th, 2019, stated that the old Pagosa carbon black plant caused enough environmental damage to that area to be toxic for the next 500 years. The second posting was made on June 6th, 2019, in which Ms. Scruggs stated that Rockport Terminals property is a Superfund site and Rockport Terminals is currently remediating it. There was a two-step process the trial court needed to engage in to decide the motion. The first step was for Ms. Scruggs to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the lawsuit arose from the exercise of her free speech or was in response to the exercise of her right to free speech. It's called protected speech. Now, Rockport Terminals correctly points out that we didn't address this in our initial appellant's brief. But what they don't point out is that the reason we didn't address this in our appellant's brief was because at oral argument, Rockport Terminal's own attorney stipulated on the record that they didn't disagree that this was protected speech, and they weren't going to waste the court's time arguing that point. Under this court's decision in Quinones versus Davalos, that is a judicial admission and it's not evidence, but it takes the issue out of the evidentiary requirement. So that's why we didn't waste the court's time. Secondly, once that was established, then the burden of proof shifted to Rockport Terminals to establish by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case of each element of each cause of action pled. They pled two causes of action, one for libel, one for business disparagement. They failed to prove by clear and specific evidence or established by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case of either cause of action. I want to first address the libel cause of action. Libel is statutorily defined as a writing which tends to injure a person's reputation or impeach a person's honesty, integrity, value, or reputation, or publish a person's natural defects. It is the only definition that a court can use. Now, in Appley's brief, they make a bare assertion the statements injured Appley's reputation. But pleading assertions are not proof, and they are not clear and specific evidence which would establish that issue. The only evidence they cite is very interesting. They cite the testimony of Mr. Epperson, an environmental expert who was retained by Rockport Terminals. Mr. Epperson testified at a temporary injunction hearing. His testimony was that labeling a piece of property a Superfund site or toxic has a negative impact on the value of property.
Well, Mr. Meyer, isn't it true that some statements, and that's the kind of the light that I took, for example, accusing someone of a criminal action or a criminal crime is a libel per se or a slander per se, depending how the communication is made. So my understanding, at least to the argument, is that by labeling it of like that, it's almost a per se. Everybody knows that's just bad. And people are going to know it's bad.
No, Your Honor, I disagree, because there's nothing illegal, improper, unethical about owning property which may or may not have been a Superfund site. Numerous individuals, numerous companies throughout the country own property which is, in fact, a Superfund site. And there's nothing untoward about that. Indeed, the statement Ms. Grubbs made went on to say not only was it a Superfund site, but that Rockport Terminals was remediating property and cleaning it up.
But let me, hey, Mr. Meyer, let me, just so that there's no confusion, in fact, that where it was mentioned it was a Superfund site and being remediated was a reposting of someone else's statement. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, but Ms. Scruggs is not running away from the statement. She reposted it. She's responsible for what was in the original statement. The second thing,
Does it matter, Mr. Meyer, in following up with Justice DeHittino, though, that it is a reposting as we review it under the statute?
Not for purposes of this appeal. I do not believe so, Your Honor. We're not relying upon that. The second thing Mr. Epperson testified was that a stigma attached to the property that prevented development of the property. And then finally, he testified that labeling property as toxic or a Superfund site gives the perception that there is something wrong with the property. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not arguing for the purposes of this appeal that either statement is true. I'm not arguing either statement did or did not disparage Rockport Terminal's commercial or business interest or impact value of its property. I'm simply arguing, regardless of whether the statements were true or false, regardless of whether they did or did not disparage Appley's business interest, regardless of whether the statements caused a stigma to attach to the plaintiff's property, the statements did not and could not injure Appley's reputation. They did not impeach Appley's honesty, integrity, virtue, or reputation, and they did not publish any of Appley's natural defects. Therefore, neither statement constituted libel, as that term is defined in the Texas Civil Practices and Remedies Code. Now, it appears to me that in its brief, Rockport Terminals tries to equate statements which might disparage a person's commercial or business interest with statements that defame a person. But the two are not synonymous, and the Supreme Court has made that very, very clear. In 1987, the Supreme Court, in the case of Hurlbut versus Gulf Atlantic Life Insurance Company, noted that the torts of defamation and business disparagement are separate torts. The court stated, quote, they protect different interests. The action for defamation is to protect the personal reputation of the injured party, whereas the action for injurious falsehood, excuse me, or business disparagement is meant to protect the economic interest of the injured party against pecuniary loss.
Well, Mr. Meyer, real quick, with regards to the difference between defamation and libel and business disparagement, with the second, there also has to be a showing of actual damages. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, and I will address that when I get to the issue of business disparagement, Your Honor. There does have to be a showing of actual damages caused by the statement, and in this case, there was not. 28 years after the Supreme Court announced the Hurlbut decision, they announced the Lipsky decision, in re Lipsky. In that opinion, the Supreme Court favorably cited a treatise that was written by a Professor Dobbs. And in that treatise, Professor Dobbs gave examples of statements that might be disparaging about business interests, but aren't defamation. And his first example that the Supreme Court cited was a publication that says the defendant's product is poisonous and contaminates the land. It may injure the plaintiff's business interest, but it doesn't defame the plaintiff because it doesn't defame the person. It casts no aspersion on the person's reputation, honesty, virtue, integrity. The Supreme Court cited that case favorably. They then applied that standard. In Lipsky, there were two defendants, a husband and a wife. The wife's motion, anti-slap motion, had been dismissed, and the Supreme Court affirmed. The husband's anti-slap motion was not dismissed. And once again, the Supreme Court affirmed, and they stated that the difference between the two decisions was because, unlike the wife, the husband had stated that the plaintiff caused environmental damage to their property. We're not arguing that at all. And that now brings me, Your Honor, to the second cause of action, which is business disparagement. There are a number of elements of this cause of action. I want to focus on two. The first element is actual malice. And in the context—
Before you go any further, Mr. Meyer, even though you would, I'm trying to kind of take a step back and trying to remember when we review this case, we are reviewing it de novo.
Yes.
All of it.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It is a de novo review.
We look at all the issues and whether evidence was presented everywhere.
That's correct. And I'm just focusing on a few of the elements, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Are you waiving the other elements, or are you just not addressing them in no way this morning?
I'm waiving them for the purposes of this appeal. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I want to talk about two of the elements of business disparagement very quickly. The first is the element of actual malice. Actual malice in the context of business disparagement means that the writer had to know the statement was false when made, or the writer had to make the statement with reckless disregard of the falsity or truth of the statement. And in that context, the test for reckless disregard is, does the person that made the statement entertain serious doubts about the truth of the statement, but make the statement anyway? It's a subjective test. It doesn't matter what Councilwoman Scruggs should have known or should have not have done. And it doesn't matter what a reasonable person should have known or should not have known. And let me be frank with the court. It's a very harsh test. Now, there is no evidence that Councilwoman Scruggs knew either statement was false. Appley, Rockport Terminals, in his brief, does state Scruggs knew the property was not a Superfund site when she accused it of being one, but pleading assertions are not clear and specific evidence which would support a prima facie case for purposes.
Well, wasn't Ms. Scruggs given all that information at a meeting, and therefore she had knowledge that what she was reposting was incorrect?
She had constructive knowledge, but there's no testimony before the court, no evidence before the court, but she heard the statement. And even if she heard the statement, there's no evidence before the court that it caused her to entertain serious doubts about whether the property was or was not, in fact, a Superfund site. Your Honor, I don't want to get too personal, but I have a son who, when he was a teenager, I used to tell him often that what he was saying was incorrect. And I can assure the court, it never caused my son to entertain serious doubts about whether or not what he was saying was true or false. And that's the test. What did Ms. Scruggs believe? What did those statements cause Ms. Scruggs to believe? Secondly, Your Honor, in regards to that, the statement was made on May 20th. I think we can all believe the statement made on May 20th, even if she believed it, couldn't possibly have caused her on May 4th to entertain serious doubts as to the truth of the statement.
I thought the reposting or the second posting occurred after the committee.
It did.
Okay.
It did. It occurred on June 6th. Okay.
Okay.
Now, I want to, the case I'm going to point to very quickly is the case of Texas Campaign for the Environment versus Partners Dewatering International. It's a very significant case. I'll have to talk about it more in my rebuttal, but it stands for the proposition that even when the defendant posted on its own website information that indicated what it was saying was false, that's not sufficient evidence to establish actual malice. Second element I want to talk about very, very quickly is cause and effect. There's no evidence from the affidavit, and I'll talk about this more fully in rebuttal, that the affidavit was the cause and effect of the special damage in this case, which was the loss of the sale of a piece of property. Hey,
Mr. Meyer, real quick, I know you're going to talk about that in your rebuttal, and I just want a yes or no. You make an argument in your brief that that in response to your motion to dismiss, that that the appellees only respond by amending their pleadings, and that that was insufficient to respond to the Citizens Participation Act's motion to dismiss. Do you concede now then that their amended pleadings are enough for us to consider?
If I made that statement, Your Honor, frankly, it was an error, and certainly you may consider the amended pleadings.
I know there was something in the brief to that that went to that matter, and I just wanted to clear that up.
Well, that was an error, Your Honor. Certainly, you may consider the amended pleadings. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. All right, Ms. White, as soon as your clock starts, you can begin your argument.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors, for allowing us to participate in oral argument and Zoom. We really appreciate this opportunity. I want to address a couple of things before getting into the deep part of the argument. But one thing that Mr. Myers said multiple times was that pleadings are not proof. And I think the law is clear that pleadings can be proof. Verified pleadings are actually considered evidence in this scenario. So we can rely on our verified pleadings and the evidence, the affidavits, and the transcript that was also attached. One thing, Justice Bisbitas, that you pointed out is this could be libel per se. And I think it absolutely fits within the definition of libel per se. To qualify as defamation per se under this category, the disparaging words must affect the plaintiff in some manner that is peculiarly harmful to the plaintiff's trade or business. This is clearly harmful to Rockport Terminal's trade and business. Mr. Myers focuses his and has conceded everything except for whether or not this is defamatory. And
Mrs.
frankly,
White, can I stop you first? And can we go back to the very first prong of this, which is, can we all agree that this is protected speech?
Trial counsel did agree that they would not dispute it below. I merely pointed out for the court that he did not address it. He didn't attach the reporter's record. I think he should have addressed it for the court, but I don't think that the court needs to hold that he waived that in order to affirm the trial court's order.
Well, it's excuse a de novo. Go ahead, Justice Dickens.
Well, excuse me. Does that mean then that you concede that it was a matter of public concern and that the burden shifted to you to show that you needed to, or that to your clients that you needed to show by clear and sufficient evidence each of the elements of the two causes of action?
I think below our trial counsel did concede that, and I don't think that there's a strong argument to say to make that this is not a matter of public concern. I think that's how she has framed this.
Well, are you conceding it now then, though?
That it is a matter of public concern.
That the burden shifted to you, and now your only argument is that you have clear and sufficient evidence on the two causes of action.
Yes, I think we can concede that.
Go ahead.
So I want to talk about the harm to Rockport's reputation. he focused his entire libel argument on that. And frankly, it's hard for me to see how Rockport Terminals could have been harmed any more than it was by Ms. Councilwoman Scruggs calling this a Superfund site and toxic for more than 500 years. Rockport Terminals put $3 million, a lot of time and effort, into remediating this property. It pulled the oil off of the property. It was never toxic. It needed to be cleaned up so that it could be ready for residential and commercial use, and so it could be sold and leased. And her statements have completely undone all of the effort that was put into that. So now the property has the reputation among the community that it is toxic and that it is a Superfund site. And that is harmful to the reputation of Rockport Terminals. We had evidence via our verified pleadings that the property value had been damaged, that we've spent $3 million remediating it. We also had the Epperson testimony, which Mr. Myers talked about, that talked about the negative impact on the value of property when it is labeled a Superfund site.
Ms. White, let me ask you a question with regards to that, because we're talking about two different posts. And in one of them, it's called a Superfund site, but in the first, it's not. Will you agree with me on that?
Yes, I agree.
And in the first post, the Rockport Terminals is not even mentioned. Is that correct?
Correct. They call it the Degussa plant.
And so you are basing it on the one line that said the Degussa carbon black plant caused enough environmental damage to the area to be toxic for the next 500 years.
Correct.
Would you agree that there's really nothing else in that statement that you would call either libel or defamation?
I agree. I think that's the main part of the argument here. But I don't think that not calling it Rockport Terminals absolves her of liability for saying that, because it's commonly known throughout the community that this is the Degussa plant. And then you have the second post. And I think that
have to make an evidentiary point of tying that in, those in the community, somebody from the community saying, well, we all know that's the Rockport Terminal. I mean, do we make that assumption somewhere along the way?
In the temporary injunction hearing, which was attached to the reporter's record for the motion to dismiss, Mr. Lancaster, who is a former defendant, he was asked if he thought it was commonly known as the Degussa plant in the community, and he agreed with that. So I think that there is some evidence.
That's enough to overcome your burden of clear and convincing evidence.
Well, I think also you can't just isolate the two posts. We need to look at them together, because this was not an isolated event. This was not even just two posts. As the cease and desist letter informed Ms. Scruggs, she was posting in forums. She was talking to the community. This was a campaign of saying this. We've used these two examples as two very obvious examples of her campaign. But when you look at the second post, it clearly ties the two together. It makes it very clear that Degussa and Rockport Terminals is the same property. So I think there is sufficient evidence to tie the two.
Okay.
As to the malice, Mr. Myers tries I think it's really important for the court to know that Mrs. Scruggs never disputed our evidence. She put on no evidence of her own, and I understand it is our initial burden, but our evidence before the trial court was that at the executive briefing, she was specifically a part of that meeting, and we have an affidavit to that effect, where she was told that this is not a Superfund site and it's not toxic. And she turned around and still reposted the Lancaster posting within days I think a week or two, and specifically called it a Superfund site. So
let me ask you a question with regards to that, because and there's somewhere, and I didn't mark it, but there's somewhere with regards to that in the brief that that suggests that she could have just looked it up. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, she so could have. Not,
my guess is that there's probably a site that lists all the Superfund sites, right?
Absolutely. There's a Superfund list.
Is that what you were alluding to, that when she was told that, she could have easily looked it up, correct?
Yes, she could have looked it up, but I don't think that she needed to. She was told that it was not a Superfund site. If she had looked it up, I think that was the point, that had she looked it up, it would have confirmed that it's not a Superfund site. I don't think we can say that because she didn't investigate that is actual malice. But when you're told that it's not a Superfund site, and you're told that the statements you are making to the public are incorrect, and you're told via a cease and desist letter that you are slandering and libeling our property, I think that arises absolutely to actual malice. And as to actual malice, also you have to look at the repost of the Lancaster posting. The Lancaster posting acknowledges that the property is being sold. And she knew that this campaign was to stop that sale in part. It was also to try to have the property annexed. So saying that, knowing that the property is being sold and labeling it a Superfund site or toxic, she knows the ramifications of that. She knows the environmental stigma that she places on the property by calling it that. We talked a little bit about the cease and desist letter. It was admitted without objection. At the trial court, counsel tried to say that there was no evidence that she received it, but there was no evidence put on by Ms. Scruggs that she did not receive the cease and desist letter that told her that the property was not toxic and that she was making false accusations that were harming the property and the potential sale. And then we have the Ray affidavit, who is the lawyer that was present at the executive briefing. And he definitively said that she was at the executive briefing and told that it was, the property was not a Superfund site. And that was admitted without objection.
She was told enough for her to, and I know that Justice DeHiddine and you discussed about having a list, but could she still, is that enough that she heard it or even saw it on the website, impute the knowledge that she knew it or knew it to be true to the extent that saying otherwise made it a false statement?
I don't know how we could have done any more. And I kind of equate this to a situation where a newspaper has written an article and has given it to the subject before they print it, and they're told specifically that fact A, B, and C are not correct, and perhaps provided information to support that. Because at the executive briefing here, it wasn't just that she was told that it's not a Superfund site. She was also provided the TCEQ certifications that showed that the property is clean. It is not toxic. And so everything she was saying was not correct. And so going back to my example, when a newspaper provides the statement to the subject of the article, and they're told A, B, and C are not correct, and then they choose to print that, then that rises to actual malice. And then as to damages, I know Mr. Meyer is going to talk about them a little bit in his rebuttal, but one, it's important to remember also that he has not challenged the damages for libel. The only thing that he has challenged is whether or not it harmed our reputation. And it's clear that a business's reputation can be harmed and we can claim libel. We can also claim business disparagement. And the damages that we put forward, we have the Cravey affidavit, we have verified pleadings that discuss the $3 million that was spent on remediating the property. And also, not only do we have the Cravey affidavit, but we have the verified petition that directly tied the loss of the sale to Mrs. Scrubb's publication.
Mrs. White, let me ask you the affidavit, can you say or can you point me to somewhere in the affidavit that points the blame on Mrs. Scruggs herself? What I see is that there's rumors in the community, but nothing in there that talks about Ms. Scruggs.
I agree that it does say that the rumors in the community, but those rumors were created and promoted by Mrs. Scruggs. And if you go to our
Mrs. White, isn't there also testimony, including the second post that was a repost of hers, even though she's taking it, that there were other people that were posting and blogging and campaigning against the sale? So how do we directly causally relate it, which is, I think, where Mr. Meyer was going to go. How do you do the causal relationship between the loss, if any, of the business directly to Ms. Scruggs and not to the other three or four? I think you actually sued two other people in this lawsuit who also
Correct.
Had said the same statements.
Correct. But I think it's important to remember that at this stage of the litigation, our burden is to show facts specific enough to show our cause of action. And to get into very distinct details, I mean, causation needs to be addressed to a certain degree, but a lot of that needs to be fleshed out at trial. And right now we have put forward evidence that, and he agrees that we have been harmed by the loss of the sale, but we've also been harmed by the loss of the $3 million remediating. But going back to that, we don't have to place all the blame on Mrs. Scruggs, right? There are numerous cases where if you republish something, you're still liable for it. It may mean that another person is liable also, but you don't have to put all of the blame on that individual person. And she's a part of those rumors. And the affidavit is very clear. Our verified pleadings are very clear that she started this campaign. She was a part of this campaign. And I think that's sufficient evidence. And specifically in our verified pleading, we say that Scruggs' publishing of the statements incited public opinion that the property had those defects and that the plaintiff was involved in such activities and which caused the concerns leading to the buyer's termination. We've talked about the two posts, but there was a lot that was happening in between and before that, that Mrs. Scruggs was involved in, and the cease and desist letter addresses that to a certain extent. Does the court have any other specific questions that I haven't answered for you?
I have a question. Was the property ultimately annexed by Port Aransas?
Yes. I don't believe that's in the record, but it was annexed.
And you said as part of the damages for the business disparagement, you're claiming that it was the loss of the sale, which was 20 million, something like that. And in addition, are you claiming that the cost of the remediation is also damages for the business disparagement?
I think it's there's evidence that it has devalued the property. And I think there's also evidence that we put $3 million into remediation.
Well,
and
but my question is, how does the $3 million into the remediation, how are her statements the cause of the loss of the $3 million. When it was first purchased, correct?
The $3 million that was put into the property?
Yes.
Yes. And I think it's just important to remember why we bought this property in the first place. The whole point was to put $3 million or a number into it to clean it so that it could be sold and used commercially or residentially. So by putting the money into it and then having a clean property and something that needed to have a strong reputation for being clean, when you put $3 million into it and then Ms. Scruggs comes in and says, it's toxic, it's a Superfund site, you have lost every bit of value and effort you've put into that property.
Well, but you argued that she would have had the ability to search on whether or not it was a Superfund site, but wouldn't also a sophisticated buyer, I'm guessing you're only getting sophisticated buyers on a $20 million piece of property, doing their due diligence, wouldn't they be able to find out that it's not a Superfund site?
Right. I think they could, but I think when you create rumors in the community that the property is toxic and there is a campaign against it, you are pushing buyers away from it. But absolutely, I think they could verify that it's not a Superfund site. But if other members in the community have labeled that, especially a sitting city councilwoman, I think it has severe harmful effects on the ability to sell the property. And at the temporary injunction hearing, Mr. Epperson talked about that. He talked about the stigma that attaches when you call something a Superfund site and when you call it toxic. And it's important to know that this was never a toxic property. It was a carbon black plant, which to me, when I first read it, sounds bad, but it's oil on the surface of the property. That is inert oil that needed to be cleaned up. It is not toxic, and it never has been. And the cleanup was to get it up to a level where it could be used commercially and residentially, but not because it was toxic, but because it did need to be cleaned up.
All right, that's, unless Justice DeGadina, you have any more questions?
No.
All right, time is completed. Thank you, Mrs. White. Mr. Meyer, you will be given your 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
As soon as your clock starts, you may begin your rebuttal argument.
Yes, Your Honor. I want to begin by addressing the point that $3 million to clean up the property could possibly be an element of damage. There's no evidence in the case Ms. Grubbs went out and dumped toxic waste on the property. Rockport Terminals paid $3 million to remove hazardous waste from the property. They got the benefit of that bargain. They got clean property. Secondly, her statements about it devalues the property. Devaluing property is not a cognizant damage for purposes of business disparagement. There has to be loss of a sale of the property. Second, now I also want to turn to the case I really didn't talk about in my direct argument, but it goes to the Cravey affidavit. The affidavit has to set out facts that are admissible in evidence. All the facts about rumors in the community, those sorts of things, are based upon what Mr. Cravey was told allegedly by the buyer. Those are not admissible facts. They do not constitute evidence for purposes of this lawsuit. Additionally, another reason the Cravey affidavit is wholly inadequate is you can't look at that affidavit and tell me when any of those events in that affidavit occurred. There is no date. They may have occurred before May 4th. The sale may have been called off before May 4th. They may have occurred after May 4th. They may have occurred before June 6th. It may have occurred after June 6th. You can't tell me from looking at that affidavit which one of those two hypotheses is true. And I cite in my brief the Summers versus Fort Crockett Hotel case, in which the Court of Appeals, Houston Court of Appeals, stated that when you cannot prove cause in fact, essentially by a blank screen. You can make a rational inference from the evidence, but the evidence has to tend to prove one possibility more than the other. In that case, a mother woke up at 2 o'clock, saw her son standing on a balcony. She woke up at 5 o'clock, her son had fallen over the balcony and was dead. Her experts testified the balcony was built too low. Court appeals said, that's no proof that the balcony caused his death, and that won't support the claim. And the important thing about Summers is that it was a summary judgment case, which is the exact same evidentiary standard we use here. This court has cited that case 8 times for that specific proposition. Ms. White says that newspapers are often told, but you can still sue them. Yeah, you can sue them for defamation, but you can't sue them for business disparagement, because being told, Judge Benavides, is not actual knowledge. I'm told a lot of things, but it doesn't know I mean them. Opposing counsel tells me lots of things, but it doesn't mean I believe any of them or that it causes any doubts. Yes, a buyer and Mr. Epperson testified. If it's a Superfund site, it's in the real estate records. If the buyer wanted to find out whether it was a Superfund site, all he had to do was go to the records to find out. I cannot imagine Ma and Pa sitting around their table drinking coffee one morning, and Pa says, you know, Ma, I think I'm going to go down and buy that $20 million piece of property. And Ma says, well, don't you think we ought to check out what's in the real property records? And him saying, no, a sophisticated buyer would have looked, and a sophisticated buyer would have found it. I also want to talk about, very quickly, the dewatering case out of this court, where the plaintiff alleged that the defendant had disparaged his business by saying that they were going to use their property to dump toxic waste. The defendant published on its website the permit application that the plaintiff had made to the TCEQ that specifically said they're not going to dump any toxic waste on their website. And Judge Rodriguez in 2016 said, that's no evidence of actual malice because that doesn't prove actual knowledge. Finally, I also found it interesting that she started her argument talking about the harm to the property. Not going to deny there may or may not have been harm to the property, but there was no harm to the dignitary reputation of Rockport Terminals. And one final point very quickly, there is no such thing as libel per se. There is slander per se. Libel, you simply have to look at the definition in the statute. That's the only definition that applies. We didn't talk about damages because you don't need to for libel. They're presumed. Thank you. And I would ask the court appeals to reverse and remand to the trial court for further proceedings.
All right, that will submit this case for submission.